Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order today. This is our first day looking at Senate bills. And to start off with, I see we have a distinguished senator with us, so we're going to start with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 381.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that requires certain notices relating to real estate loans to be mailed to all addresses on file for the recipient, including post office boxes. There are no amendments, and it came across the Senate floor in a vote of 28-0.
Senator Hansel, if you'd identify yourself for the record, welcome to the committee.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, state senator for District 29, which is located in the northeast and central part of the state. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you regarding Senate Bill 381. As was mentioned, it passed unanimously out of both the Business and Transportation Committee and off the floor of the Senate. I thought it might be helpful to give you some background on how this bill came about. Typically, people receive mail at their physical address. However, for people living in rural communities, including myself, we receive our mail at a post office box, not our street address, even though we have a street address. When mail is addressed to the street address instead of the P.O. box, the postmaster will not deliver the piece of mail. It is returned to the sender. I was contacted by the former mayor of Adams, Oregon, another small rural community, who spoke to me about a major problem he experienced. He was called out by his out-of-state financial institution that his home was being foreclosed. The foreclosure came as a complete shock to him. It turns out he had not received any of the letters warning of this foreclosure. This was because he used a P.O. box. His payment schedule had been changed, so his payments, were inadequate. Since the bank sent the warning letters to his street address, he did not receive any of that correspondence. As the deficit began to grow, the bank sent him more warnings, but none were actually delivered to him. He had no idea there was a problem. When he was notified by phone that his house would be foreclosed in a few days, he knew that he had to take action. My pastor, who moved to my hometown of Athena from Arizona, had a similar issue on a loan. What Senate Bill SB 381 does, if a post office box is listed as a mailing address along with a physical address, the lending institution must use it for loan foreclosure documents. Although some might view this bill as minor, by passing Senate Bill 381, we can ensure that events similar to the ones experienced by the Adams mayor and my pastor, or many other in rural Oregon, will not happen again. My preference would have been to include all legal documents, but legislative counsel felt this might be too complicated at this time. So Senate Bill 381 only includes foreclosures, those kind of documents. Thank you very much, and Chair Hovey and members of the committee for taking time to hear Senate Bill 381, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee?
Makes sense.
One quick question.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the bill allow for forwarding?
It really doesn't, Chair Hovey and Representative Bynum. Forwarding really isn't the issue here so much. The post office box, it's getting it to the person through the post office itself. It doesn't forward to an address that they don't have. It'd be like if they moved. I'm only three blocks from the post office box. They could put it in, but I think there's probably some legal requirements with the federal post office department that doesn't allow them to do that, even though they know who I am. They return to sender. So forwarding would probably mean an address in another community or something. They can still do that, but they can't put it in the box if it's not the correct address on the box.
Follow up.
The reason I ask is because I've had a tax notice that I haven't received because the taxing district put on the notification, do not forward, and I had moved. and I had not notified them, but life was happening, and so that was their, that was the taxing district's way of taking people's land. So that's why I asked.
I understand.
Okay. So, Senator, this this notice is being sent by the lenders, so it's the address and the post office box that are on file with the lender that the notices must be sent to? So it's got to be sent to both if they're both on file with the lender?
Representative Hovey, yes. If the recipient, if the client lists a post office box, as we all do when we send out our mailing address, it that needs to be used. We'll also, it's kind of a catch-22 because, you know, obviously we have a physical address, and that's required on the documents too. And not only, not on some documents, it's not always clear that you could have a different mailing address. They just send it to the physical, unless you require them, if a post office box is in fact listed, that they need to include that too. Now, the purpose is trying to protect the landowner from unintended consequences, so that they're not like the mayor, didn't even know that this whole process was underway.
Right.
And my my pastor kept waiting for the documents to arrive, and they never did. Well, what he didn't realize, they were being sent back.
Yeah. And to clarify, you know, it is a list that the lender has, not the list that the post office has. Of
correct.
The,
correct. Sorry. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right.
The lender would need to have it. If I may say, if the document does not have a P.O. box listed, if the, for whatever reason, I don't think we can hold the lender, nor should we, accountable. But if it is listed, that's what the bill says, then it helps the lendee to make the
payments. Right. Just want to make sure that the lendees are getting the notice.
Yeah.
Any other comments, questions? Thank you very much for presenting this bill to us today. Appreciate it. I don't see anyone else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 381. Nobody else? I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 381. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 96A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure requires proof of errors in emissions insurance policy with the application for a license or renewal of a license as a broker-dealer or estate investment advisor. It requires insurance in the amount of at least $1 million, provides exemptions, and it specifies that it becomes operative July 31 of 2018. There are no amendments. It came across the Senate on a vote of 17 to 10.
All right. Maybe we'll hear from Gary Byrne and Robert Banks, maybe?
That's right.
Oh, no. Could have had them up first, but.
Go ahead. Okay.
Good afternoon, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Robert Banks.
Go ahead and proceed.
Okay, thank you. I am an attorney. I've been a member of the Oregon State Bar since 1982, and most of my practice during those years has been involving the financial services industry and the rules and regulations surrounding it. I have represented and been and am an advisor to the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, otherwise known as FINRA. I've taught the investment arbitration class at Lewis and Clark Law School for several years, and I have represented both brokers and investors over the years. Most of my practice involves representing investors. And when I say investors, it's a little bit of a misnomer because not talking about big money type investors, they're really savers. Most of the people that I represent are seniors, and the disputes often involve their retirement accounts. And I can tell you that I've spoken with a lot of them over the last few decades, and This issue of insurance comes up a lot, and it arises like this. Someone will come to my office. They will present a fact situation to us. I'll listen to it, and I'll say, you know, I think you're right. You have lost a lot of money in your retirement account, and it happened because somebody made a mistake. But I'm advising you not to bring that case, not to spend the money on it, because there isn't any liability insurance, and I don't think that the person who was advising you would have the means to pay any judgment or award that we would be able to get for you. And these claims, they range anything from just a simple mistake to all the way to fraud. And that happens less often. But a typical case involving negligence might be something like somebody mistakenly withdraws money from an IRA account, a retirement account. It should have come out of another account, and all of a sudden there's a big tax liability, because when you withdraw money from an IRA, you have to pay taxes on it. Wasn't intentional, but nonetheless it was a mistake that could cost somebody a significant amount of money. Sometimes it's reckless conduct, and those kinds of cases are where an advisor maybe churned an account, purchased and sales of a lot of securities over a short amount of time with the primary goal of generating commissions. And sometimes they're outright fraud. Not that often, but sometimes a broker will get a check from a client and stick it in his own bank account. We see that. And in all of these cases, whether it's negligence or fraud or just, either of those, if there's no insurance, there really is no claim. Because it's not even worth it for these people to spend the money for the filing fees to pursue them, because we know what's going to happen. And what's going to happen is we're going to go through that case for them, we're going to prove that they were wronged, and there's nothing to recover. And I want to mention a very good example of a case that we are still handling. That occurred. We had a hearing last year for a family. It's actually an extended family, and I can mention their names because they were here to testify in the first go round when this bill was heard on the Senate side. It's a Ryan family, and Mrs. Ryan, Doreen Ryan, is in her 80s, and she and her husband, while he was still alive, had invested with an advisor, a broker in Oregon, and didn't realize for quite a number of years that the accounts that were being managed for her had been churned consistently. And in fact, when we went to the hearing in front of a FINRA board, they found, and I brought the award with me, that these accounts were being charged between 10 and 16% of the account value every year.
True.
There were that many trades in the account, and Mrs. Ryan didn't understand that. And after a four-day hearing, the panel awarded her $197,000. And all that represented was getting back the commissions that she had unknowingly paid for all of those years. We got that award last September, and not a penny of it has been paid. The broker has filed for bankruptcy. The firm has filed for bankruptcy. They carried absolutely no liability insurance. And the chances that she's ever going to see that money are, I would say, next to zero. And that's one recent example, but these things happen all the time. And I just feel very strongly that, you know, you have to have insurance to drive a car. You have to have insurance to get a mortgage. I certainly have to have insurance to practice law, but someone can manage the life savings of people and carry absolutely no liability insurance. It's just wrong. Thank you, Chair Holby. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Hey, go ahead and
Chair Holby, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Gary Byrne. I'm a lawyer in Portland with the law firm of Stoll Byrne. I spent about 40 years doing investment fraud cases along with other things. I won't repeat what's in my written testimony or what Mr. Banks said. Except I would like to add two things. One is an example, and the other is to talk about some of the things that have happened in the industry in recent years that have made this even more important. Because one thing that we've seen is the growth of smaller investment advisory firms, where it can be a one-person operation, for example, and the person might be managing tens of millions of dollars. And in a typical setup, the investment advisor will have discretion from the customer, authority from the customer to make trades. But the account will be, say, at Fidelity or Charles Schwab or usually a discount brokerage firm. But the firm, the brokerage firm, does not supervise that investment advisor. The brokerage firm is simply holding the money. So it's not a situation where you're at Merrill Lynch, your broker's at Merrill Lynch, and Merrill Lynch has to supervise the broker. So in these investment advisor situations, there's nobody supervising the investment advisor. And Charles Schwab or Fidelity or TD Ameritrade or whoever does not usually have responsibility for the account other than to make the trades when they get an order from the investment advisor. That investment advisor might have no financial backing to speak of, but they have tens of millions of dollars of responsibility. And that's one of the problems that this bill corrects, because they will be required to have $1 million of insurance. And just as another example, I had a case where a woman went to an investment advisor, and he put her whole account in what's called a triple leverage short exchange traded funds. That, so your money's at three times at risk, and you will only make money if the market goes down. And he did that at the bottom of the market in 2009. There actually was a warning from FINRA saying these are only suitable for short-term day traders. But this was a widow in her late 60s. All of her money was in this. She lost most of it. She came to us. There was no insurance, and there was no way for her ever to collect. So that's the kind of thing that we're trying to take care of, and this bill does that.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this insurance is available now, I would assume, but what this bill does is require them to have at least $1 million in liability coverage. So then my question would be, do most investors have insurance, or most do, some don't? Or
I would say, Chair Hovey and Representative Barreto, that yes, most do, and some don't really need it, the Merrill Lynch's, the Wells Fargo's, but it's the smaller firms that Mr. Byrne was referring to that oftentimes don't have it. I don't have a statistic, and I don't know that there is one, but I can tell you that we see it a lot.
Representative Fee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know if any other states require E&O insurance for these folks?
Do you?
No.
I Chair Hovey and Representative Fari, I don't know.
Other questions? Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as I think about it, you know, investing is can be complicated. And sometimes it's a little hard to know whether you got a winner or a loser, or bad luck, or ill advice. How does this bill differentiate those kinds of responsibilities?
Well, Chair Hovey and Representative Kinnamer, the bill only requires the firm to have insurance.
Sue to figure it out.
Well, yeah, the insurance company, it's not their obligation to figure it out, and hopefully the lawyers don't advise their clients to bring claims that aren't good claims. You're certainly correct that it's not always an easy thing to figure out if there is a claim, but, you know, there's nothing that this bill would do to change that.
Thank you.
And just curious, do you personally feel like $1 million is enough? When I think about somebody's life savings, it seems like $1 million in today's world maybe isn't quite sufficient, but I guess it's better than nothing.
More would be better. Million-dollar policies are fairly typical. So, for example, a lot of firms that that license a lot of independent representatives will require them to have $1 million of insurance. So it might be a national firm that licenses somebody, say, in Portland or Eugene or wherever. So those are fairly typical-sized policies that are available.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Kinnemer.
Follow up on your question, Mr. Chair. What range does $1 million policy cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kinnemer, there is information from DCBS.
Okay.
I believe it was about $2,000. Is that correct?
Okay.
And that
we'll
is
be hearing from them next.
That's so. Pretty modest, though.
Thank you, Representative Doherty.
Another quick question. So, do you feel that the $1 million covers most of the sort of investments people have? Or do you think that investors that are availing themselves of these have far more than $1 million?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, it would cover a lot of claims.
Okay.
It certainly wouldn't cover all of them. In terms of percentage, I think it would be a lot, but there's some very big losses that we see.
More than they are now. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Any other? Well, thank you, gentlemen. I certainly wish this was in place when some brokerage firm enticed me with a great investment called Enron. So,
50 or 100 million?
This policy would have covered it. Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Mine paid off at a little company called Microsoft.
Rick Blackwell and Aaron Teberbaugh. I always.
He invested in.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, Policy Manager with the Division of Financial Regulation. We're here to ask for your support on Senate Bill 96. This is actually a broader strategy that the department is pursuing to both protect investors through enhanced exams at the front end so that we catch problems before they occur, and also ensuring that there is some reasonable financial backstop when the unfortunate does nonetheless occur. So our department regulates investment advisors, so these are the folks that are giving you advice on what to purchase or what to invest in, and also broker-dealers, so the folks that buy your stocks. Though primarily we are seeing a shift towards investment advice as people trade in their own stocks or start using what's known as robo-advisors, which is kind of an algorithmic-based trading, sort of how to figure out how to buy trades or make trades on the stock market. Investment advisors are examined every 3 years by our office. Usually we identify issues and resolve them at the exam stage, but sometimes we're not able to, and so we still end up with instances of mismanagement and breaches of fiduciary duty, so the kinds of negligent activities that were brought up by the first panel. Under current law, to protect against losses, Oregon requires a $10,000 bond, which can be raised to $100,000 by rule. It was a project we looked at a couple years ago, but we learned that raising a bond to $100,000 can be fairly expensive and or maybe not able to be obtained in the first place. So someone with excellent credit and no trouble whatsoever, no issues with maybe declines in the stock market from the financial crisis, might be able to get a $100,000 bond for about $1,500, and it goes up substantially from there. We can raise the amount of the bond to 100, as I said, by rule, but again, then we've magnified the issues about availability and access and affordability to the bond. So other states, maybe to answer Representative Fahey's question, most states either have a net worth requirement, which is quite variable depending on what happens to the investments of the advisor themselves, or they also have a surety bond requirement. Typical bonds in the states are about $35,000. I will note that no other state has yet required errors and omissions insurance. I think that might be due to us putting this forward, I think is possibly due to the fact that we regulate insurance and securities together, and so maybe we had a different perspective than some other state commissioners. To figure out, so, you know, you've heard from the first panel that there was a sense of what kinds of issues there might be. We looked through the Central Registration Depository. This is the licensing database for that all 50 states use to license these professionals. We found 1,591 disclosable events, which are things that need to be disclosed to investors. Primary cause of complaints are things like suitability standards. So for instance, having someone buy oil and gas stocks when they really have a risk profile that's geared toward preserving their nest egg for retirement. Misrepresentations, failing to disclose key information, excessive sale charges, what Mr. Banks had raised, and also mistakes in entering orders or failing to enter orders. So these are all really negligent types of events. These are things that are not necessarily needed to be proved that someone had a state of mind to do that. So that's a key component of what we're looking at. Obviously, outright fraud is not usually covered by these types of insurance policies. And so, but what we're seeing primarily is outside of the cases that we take at the department are that there's negligence level events. Claims are usually subject to arbitration, but to build on what Mr. Banks had mentioned, one out of three investor awards are actually not paid nationally. And so there's a significant amount of unpaid judgments that are out there. The Public Interest, Public Investor Arbitration Bar Association had looked at the issue in 2013, had recommended some kind of central settlement account instead. We're trying to do something here at this level. There may be other things that happen eventually, but for now, we seem to be on an ad hoc basis amongst the states. So what Senate Bill 96 does is basically requires all securities licensees to have errors and omissions insurance. The minimum coverage is $1 million. Certainly, people are free to elect to have more. The rulemaking, I mentioned earlier that we had started down this path of rulemaking on the bond. We also did some informal research among agents to figure out how much an insurance policy would be. And to your question, Representative Kennemer, the average premium seemed to be around $2,000 for a $1 million coverage, which was fairly available and seemed fairly reasonable to protect yourself and to have a backstop. So again, you know, you've heard already, this is really akin to liability coverage for lawyers. And it's a best practice, too. I mean, a lot of firms actually carry this insurance in order to protect themselves, as it does cover legal defense coverage. It's also a means for an entity to protect itself from possibly frivolous lawsuits. And so with that, I will end my testimony and take any questions you might have.
Questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you had mentioned these complaint or negligent mistakes, you know, that they're sued for. Do they also get sued for just poor investing or just poor advice, you know, like they recommend, you know, a certain investment in a certain area, it doesn't return, and so they get sued for that?
Chair Holvey and Representative Barreto, I mean, I could imagine cases where someone might, against judgment of counsel, pursue a case like that.
Would that be a frivolous type suit then?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barreto, you know, it's probably not up for me to determine what a frivolous lawsuit is. Be up to the courts. So.
Other questions? Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is $2,000 a significant burden on the expense line of the broker? I'm agent. I don't know what to call them.
Oh, investment advisor. Sorry.
Investment advisor.
Yeah. Chair Holvey and Vice Chair Bynum, we did, well, I mean, again, of course, this is something that, while required, we thought $2,000 per year would be fairly reasonable for the businesses to carry that.
Is it per year?
Actually, I'm sorry, if I may turn to my lifeline here. So,
Chair Holvey, Representative Bynum, for the record, my name is Aaron Tieberbaum, a senior policy analyst at the Division of Financial Regulation. One thing that we looked at with regard to the premium, whether or not it would pencil out against a bond premium, is that it can be written off as a business expense. So the $2,000 annually, that's kind of standard, but it'll depend on a lot of underwriting criteria, like how much you have under management, your credit history, your risk history, things like that. So that versus either the inability to obtain a bond because you have either not the net worth or too much under assets, or simply you don't have the personal finances to get a bond, it did seem to pencil out more reasonably for even the smaller firms.
Representative Kinnemeyer.
I guess another question that I have is I just wonder how many clients this would cover. You know, if you have an investment counselor, or whatever you want to call them, and they're making serious errors in judgment, it's probably across a fair number of advisees that are clients that they are taking care of. And is this going to cover all of their clients?
That was a question I had, too. Is this $1 million in the total universe, or is this $1 million for each customer that's been aggrieved, perhaps?
Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnemeyer. Typically, although it's not really clear from the language in the bill, typically it's a $1 million policy with a $5 million aggregate. Some of the numbers that we've pulled off of the CRD system is that your average IRA account, which is where we're starting, the damage that we're kind of waiting or trying to prevent, the average IRA account is about not quite $90,000. The average IRA account for persons or investors over 70 is about $177,000. So even in some of the larger cases, not everybody's going to be damaged. Not everybody's going to be damaged uniformly. But if it is a $1 million with a $5 million aggregate, it should provide some substantial protection for investors, for all the investors under a firm.
And currently there's a $10,000 bond required, is that right?
Chair Holvey, that's correct.
Yep. And that will remain as a requirement as well?
Yes.
Thank you. Any other questions? Really interesting. Thank you very much for bringing the bill forward. And no one else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 96.
We're really not going to have any other testimony.
It doesn't look like it. Okay. No one else signed up to testify. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 96. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 330.
Chair and committee members, this is a measure that modifies the conditions under which an insurer or a supervising entity can terminate the portable electronics insurance coverage. Specifies that electronic notice or correspondence related to the portable electronics coverage may be sent to a vendor policyholder under different circumstances than those under which the notice may be sent electronically to the customer. There are no amendments today. It came across the Senate on a vote of 26-0.
Is that?
And up on this bill, Sean Miller and Raul Paul. Sorry. Paul. I can't read your last name. I'm sorry. I know you printed.
What some people call my printing, Fassbender.
thank you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of Assurion, which is a company that offers portable electronics insurance, and so it's the insurance for your cell phone. And in support of Senate Bill 330, and just before we turn it over to Paul to kind of go through the policy reasons, we were pretty early adopters of putting portable electronics in the insurance statute. We worked with the insurance division, and prior to the 2011 session, it was your committee, Mr. Chairman, 2011, the Consumer Protection Committee at the time, Jan's committee, that adopted that and put that in the insurance statute. So the two provisions revisions that Paul will talk about is really just making some policy changes to that original bill that line it up with most of the rest of the country as the rest of the country adopted that. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Paul.
Thanks. Thank you.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Fassbender. I'm with a company based in Nashville, Tennessee, called Assurion. We're one of the larger insurance providers for portable electronics insurance. Our client base includes AT&T, Verizon, and Sprint. And kind of give you a flavor of where our company comes into play in the transaction is when you go to a store to get a phone, and after you determine the phone, the minute plan, the text plan, they ask you, would you like protection on the phone? That is the insurance we provide. We're underwritten, depending on client, by a number of large insurance companies. When this bill was put into place, as Sean said, in 2011, there were a number of things not anticipated. At that time, we did not have a statutory structure in all 50 states, which we have today. And what we are doing back now is coming back and trying to clean up and modernizing the act in certain states to make it a little more streamlined and level in all the states. And the two provisions here today that I want to talk about first would be the notification provision, which would change, and this bill would change it from 60 days to 30 days. 30 is one of the more standard terms across the country, and that's what we'd be aimed to do. And this notification would affect the modification or termination of the policy. The second would be an e-notice provision. Now, at the time when, in 2011, when this bill came into Oregon, as Sean said, y'all were part of the first adopters of this bill. E-notice had not really taken the insurance, I'd say, community by storm yet. And as it went on, it did, and a number of states passed e-notice provisions. Our product's a little different. E-notice is allowed in 37 states. We are trying to go back and fix the rest, and many of them were early adopters of this bill. Thing that makes it interesting for our company is we're not there at the transaction, like many companies who provide insurance are. The cell phone carriers are selling our policies, and we're not able to have a presence there to say, hey, do you want e-notice or don't you want e-notice? What this legislation would do would have us comply with portions of the Oregon Electronic Transaction Act. And the consumer still has the option of opting out. The consumer would still have the option of receiving paper notices. This would just make it a little easier for us to send e-notices here in Oregon, which currently we can do, but the consent laws make it unreasonable to do so in the face of the transaction that we're dealing with through this bill.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't have any questions about the two provisions that you talked about. That seems really straightforward to me. But the one provision you didn't discuss is the one about the 15 days. Right now, there's 15 days notice to cancel a policy for failure to pay premiums, and we're eliminating that 15 days so they can immediately terminate the policy if there's non-payment. So would love to hear a little bit about why you're proposing that change, and a little bit about, you know, does that mean that if someone is a day late in paying their premium that the policy can be canceled?
Yeah, Chair Holby, Representative Fahey, actually, that was a legislative council change, and so I think what you're referring to is on line 23 for non-payment of premium where it deletes that. What legislative council did, and we didn't even request this, is if you turn the page on page 2, they add the enrolled customer fails to pay a required premium. So I think what they did, and at least a question to legislative counsel, and I'm happy to clarify that, is I think they just, in their own way of drafting, reworded that because that was not in our original proposal. And so because I think, you know, like I said, it deletes lines 23 and they add lines 2 because really we were just dealing with the other two provisions. And so I think that keeps it consistent with the current statute. But it's something I'm happy to go back to legislative council and clear up.
Chair and representative, just to clarify, in some states, just to clarify here, a lot of states do allow immediate cancellation simply by virtue of our billing methods are through the phone bill. So if they cease to have service There's nowhere to track, there's nowhere to get a payment, and they're not using their phone for the purpose that it's intended to be insured for.
Yes, any other questions? To follow up on Representative Fahey, maybe didn't stand out. Maybe it's not a change from current policy, but when a customer fails to pay a required premium, it doesn't seem like there's any grace period mentioned in that statement. And, with today's world of mail showing up late sometimes and not on other times, seems like there ought to be a grace period for making that required premium payment.
And, Chair, are you referring to the 15 days we were just talking about or the modification or termination?
Well, I'm not sure if the 15 days actually was applicable to the non-payment of premium to start with. I'm just questioning whether there should be some sort of grace period. What was the 15-day a grace period and the previous reiteration of the statute?
Yeah, that's my understanding. What I'll do, Mr. Chairman, is I'll go back to Legislative Council following this and ask that question and then get the answer to that, because we're not intending to change that. And as for the 30 days when it talks about modification or termination, That really applies to your current bill, because it's really a month to month policy now. If you want to explain that, Paul, because you're paying your cell phone bill month to month now, and so that's really the only thing that we were really trying to change. But I'll clarify the actual language there, because I don't think it's our intent to change that language. But I don't want to get Legislative Council's.
Yeah.
Can I just have one comment?
I mean,
thank you, Mr. Chair. So it does look like right now it's written such that in 23 they can cancel, line 23 they can cancel for non-payment of premiums. Line 24 it says under that subsection you must give them 15 days notice. And the non-payment of premium was moved into the section where they can immediately terminate.
Right.
So it reads to me like that is an actual substantive change from current policy. And it's one that I would like further discussion on if we're actually going
to. I would concur with that. Well, that's sort of the way I'm looking at it, too. I'm a little concerned about that.
Yeah.
If in fact, that's a error by Legislative Council, I'd like to see that fixed.
Or by us. We'll clear that up. I'm not blaming anybody, but we'll make sure we get that clear.
All right, great.
Thank you, Sean.
Any other questions, comments? Not seeing any. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here to testify on this bill.
Thank you.
See no one else signed up for Senate Bill 330. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 330. Just in time. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 331. Paul Cosgrove.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that allows an insurer to offer an insured a replacement policy in lieu of renewing the prior policy as long as the insurer provides notice to the insured and the insurance producer at least 45 days before the renewal date. Permits the insured to cancel a policy at any time before the effective date. Provides that the earned premium for the period in which the policy was in effect before the cancellation must be calculated on a pro rata basis using the current rate or the previous year's rate, whichever one is lower. And it specifies that new rates and changes in the terms for a replacement policy agreed to by the insured becomes effective the day following the expiration of the previous policy. Came across the Senate on a vote of 29-0, and there are no amendments.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove representing Nationwide Insurance. This is a bill brought forward by Nationwide, but it also is, I think, relevant to other insurers. The situation that Nationwide faces at this point, having been operating in the state for a number of years, in fact, this is the first state west of the Mississippi that Nationwide offered insurance many years ago, is it has a number of subsidiaries offering similar or, in some cases, almost identical kinds of insurance, home, auto, life. And it is at the position right now where it would like to consolidate some of those. So in some of those subsidiaries, it no longer offers new policies to a new customer, but it has a number of customers who are still buying their insurance through that subsidiary. What this bill does is allow a simple and, we think, much more consumer-friendly way to transfer people to a different subsidiary. Under the current law, the way you would have to do that is you would have to give the person a notice of non-renewal and then offer them a new policy. And the reason a notice of non-renewal is not a very consumer-friendly option is that if you're insured for your home and your bank is an additional insured, as it normally would be on a mortgage, that notice of non-renewal goes to the bank. Same on your car. If your car lender is an additional insured on your car loan, that notice of non-renewal goes to them. Even if you accepted the new policy, you'd have to explain to your car lender or your bank lender that, you know, the non-renewal isn't really going to happen. I'm just transferring companies. So this is a new process that says we give you notice in advance, 45 days. We'd like to move you from Company A to Company B. They're both under common ownership. Here's what the differences are in the terms and provisions and rates of your policy. You can accept it if you want. You don't have to accept it. You can go elsewhere. You can shop with other companies. But if you do accept it, we'll move you seamlessly into the new company without this non-renewal notice going to either your bank or your car lender or any other person who has an interest in that insurance policy. So that's the reason for the bill. We think it's a good bill and good for both consumers and for insurers, and would urge your support. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions on this bill? Senate Bill 331. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the bill doesn't offer any guarantees about rate increases, but it can you assure us that it's not a tool to outright go for rate increases by moving people around and shuffling?
Madam Chair, Representative Bynum, in fact, if your driving record, say, in a car has changed in that year, in fact, you'll get a rate increase whether you stay or whether you go to the new subsidiary. So there may be changes in rates because of things that have to do with your ability to be insured. But in most cases, we are talking about subsidiaries that are standard auto to a standard auto, so there won't be any significant difference in rates. And that will be explained to the consumer in this 45-day notice period. So if they don't like the new rate for whatever reason, because they don't think they think they're a better driver or whatever reason, they can go shop. It's literally to move subsidiaries to a fewer number and have so for administrative simplicity, not for rate changes. But there might be rate changes, as I pointed out, because of factors like your driving record has deteriorated or something else like that.
And I would assume that in changing a policy, you might end up with a policy that has slightly different benefits to it, and that would also dictate a potential rate change, either up or down.
Correct, Mr. Chair. In fact, the legislature sometimes changes the requirements for policies on what kind of PIP coverage you'd have, personal injury protection coverage, and well, or any number of other things that might have positive or negative effects, and those will all also be explained. Those explanations of changes also happen if you're just renewing in the same company, but they would also happen in this change of company, so you would know what's different from your prior policy.
Thank you. I sort of remember the PIP change. Any other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
No one else cares to testify on Senate Bill 331. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 331. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 134.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is a measure brought forward by Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum. It subjects motor vehicle sellers and buyers to certain conditions that are contingent on the lender's agreement or failure to agree to purchase a retail installment contract or lease agreement for a motor vehicle. Clarifies the amount that the seller can charge the buyer who returns a vehicle due to the failure of the lender to purchase a retail contract for the miles traveled prior to returning the vehicle. There are no amendments, and it came across the Senate on a vote of 29-0.
Thank you. Josh Bidwell.
Good
Good afternoon. Welcome. If you identify yourself for the record.
Yes, sir. Thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. Chair Holvey, Vice Chairs Barreto and Bynum, members of the committee. My name is Josh Bidwell. I'm the legislative assistant for the Department of Justice and the Attorney General's Office. Senate Bill 134 is a very simple bill that is, in fact, much simpler than it might appear on paper. It really just updates the term financing that is currently used in statute to what is more accurately used in everyday transactions, which is a retail installment contract. Nothing is changing as far as what is actually going on. It's just cleaning up the language to reflect what's actually happening in practice. It also goes on to say that if a dealer cannot secure financing for one of these retail installment contracts and they have to send that notification to the purchaser of a vehicle, they can send that via an electronic communication rather than having to send them a letter. Again, nothing is changing as far as what they're having to send. It just says they can send it via a written electronic communication rather than a letter. And it finally goes on to clarify that if that person has already obtained the vehicle from the dealer, so it was called a spot delivery, so they've entered into the agreement with the dealer, but they haven't agreed to, they haven't had financing confirmed yet. Well, within that 14 days, if the dealer sends that notification and the person needs to bring the vehicle back, it just clarifies how the dealer can calculate the mileage that they need to be reimbursed for when the vehicle was driven off the lot. It truly is a simple bill, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them for you.
Thank you. Committee, any difficult questions for this simple bill?
We could take a recess.
I was trying to come up with a really tough question for you, but I'm not coming up with it right off the top of my head. It's Monday.
I tried thinking of some, and I couldn't think of any myself.
Well, I appreciate your testimony, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
No one else signed up for Senate Bill 134. And, Jan, would you remind me what the vote on the Senate was on that bill?
On 134?
Yes.
29-0.
Okay. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 134. And committee,
yeah.
We zoomed through our first day of the Senate bills. And appreciate you being here. And see you Wednesday. With that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. Adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.